Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. As you no doubt know by now, this year marks the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic, but there's one story associated with the destruction of the great ocean liner with which you might not be intimately familiar. If you've seen any of the three most popular movies about the subject, you probably remember a married couple who refused to be separated as the lifeboats were filling up with women and children. Those characters were based on Ida and Isidore Strauss, real-life Titanic victims. Now their full backstory is being told in A Titanic Love Story, Ida and Isidore Strauss, a new book by June Hall McCash, founding director of the MTSU Honors Program and former chair of the Department of Foreign Languages and Literatures. We'll relive the Titanic experience through the eyes of two German-Jewish immigrants who found America to be the land of opportunity until the bittersweet end. After this, from MTSUNews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUNews.com, the university's news and information website. MTSU quarterback Logan Kilgore is among 117 players nationwide nominated for the All-State Insurance Company and the American Football Coaches Association's Good Works Team. Kilgore works regularly with the Special Olympics and is involved in the Read Across America program. And Dr. Charles Perry, who holds the Russell Chair of Manufacturing Excellence, and a five-member team has improved gas mileage anywhere from 50 to 100% on a 1994 Honda station wagon retrofitted with laboratory prototype plug-in hybrid capability. Perry is now talking with several potential investors to solicit funds to build and demonstrate a manufacturing version of the plug-in hybrid technology. For news at any time from Middle Tennessee State University, go to mtsunews.com.
June, thanks for being our guest today on MTSU on the Record.
It's a great pleasure.
How did Ida and Isidore Strauss meet?
Well, that in itself is an interesting story, and there's a lot of story that goes into the background of how they met. He was too young to serve in the military. He was only 17 at the time, and even though he tried to enlist, he tried to become an officer, in fact, in the Confederate Army. He was turned down because of his age, and as a consequence, he became a blockade runner, and he was going to join a small blockade running company in Georgia called the Georgia Import-Export Company. And when he ran the blockade out of Charleston, South Carolina, he went to Cuba, and with him he carried a letter of introduction to Amanda Rothschild's father, Nathan Blunn. And Nathan Blunn happened to be the father also of Ida Blunn, who would eventually become Isidore's wife.
And the two of them were a true love story. It was not the case of someone just latching on and being a gold digger to somebody who had already made it. Isidore didn't make it until well into their marriage.
Absolutely. In fact, his father came to this country in the 1850s, the early 1850s, and became a peddler in the state of Georgia. He drove a wagon from plantation to plantation and sold goods off his wagon. And within one generation, they would own Macy's Department Store. But it was a difficult time during the Civil War, following the Civil War. And when Isidore came home from England, he had successfully accumulated $10,000 in gold, and that's how his family started over again in New York. With that amount of money, he was able to buy his family a home and furnish it in New York City, and also to help his father get started again in business, because they had virtually lost everything during the war. Since the last real battle of the Civil War was fought in Columbus, Georgia, after the signing of the peace treaty at Appomattox, and the city was virtually destroyed during that period of time.
And did the Strausses encounter much anti-Semitism in Georgia?
At first, no. In fact, Lazarus Strauss, Isidore's father, in letters home, commented on how he had encountered virtually no anti-Semitism. And he made the comment that people here don't know about Jews. And he felt that the ostracism and the negativism was directed toward toward the slaves, toward the blacks, rather than toward the Jews. However, during the Civil War, the anti-Jewish sentiment, the anti-Semitism, reared its ugly head in the sense of people beginning to accuse Jews of profiteering during the Civil War. Well, of course, many people did profiteer. Lazarus Strauss was not one of them. He was probably one of the most honest men who ever walked the earth. In fact, after the Civil War, even after the people in the North had written off all his debts, assuming he would never be able to pay for the goods he had ordered that spring, he went to the suppliers in Philadelphia and New York and paid every penny he owed, with the comment that and they tried to say, no, you don't have to. We've already written off these debts. He said, no, if I leave my children nothing else, I will leave them a good name. And so they had, of course, not profiteered in the sense that the Jews in a general way were being accused of. However, he was deeply offended, and that happened in a little town called Talbotton, Georgia, and that was what prompted them to move to Columbus, Georgia. In fact, Isidore, after he became co-owner with his brother Nathan of Macy's department store, he was very wealthy New Yorker at the time, very well known, a man known for his good works and his benefactions, his benevolence, wrote to the headmaster of St. Bernard's Academy in support of his grandson's application to be admitted to that school, and the headmaster was obliged to write him back, and he did it with a great deal of regret that if they admitted what he called a Hebrew child, that they would lose their other children in that school, and so the little boy was not admitted. And this was a very, very wealthy family in New York by this time and very well known.
We'll talk more about Ida and Isidore Strauss and this new book by June Hall McCash in just a moment. This is MTSU on the Record.
Women in Science and Engineering, or WISE, helps college women prepare for and become involved in science-related careers. WISE nurtures women's interest in these fascinating and critical fields and provides mentoring and networking opportunities. The group's main goal is to assure women of their importance in all scientific and technical fields and to promote equal opportunity and treatment of women in science. I'm Dr. Judith Iriarte-Gross, WISE Advisor.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're back with June Hall McCash talking about a Titanic love story, Ida and Isidore Strauss. So how did Isidore come to own Macy's department store?
Well, he and his father and his brother Nathan owned another company called L. Strauss and Sons. Now, that's not Levi Strauss. That's Lazarus Strauss.
Okay.
It's L. Strauss and Sons, and they imported crockery and china and that sort of thing. And they decided they would like to open some concessions in some of the major department stores around the country. And Nathan Strauss approached R.H. Macy, who was the owner at the time of Macy's department store, and was able to lease a portion of the basement of Macy's department store. And they became one of the most successful parts of the store and certainly helped Macy's gain an even greater reputation.
So it started almost as a sort of a consignment arrangement.
It was, indeed. Although Nathan was working with that particular group at the time, but he, as soon as R.H. Macy died, his store passed on to some of his younger relatives and to someone he had kind of adopted as his surrogate son, since he had been a bit disappointed in his own son. But in any case, little by little, these other owners of Macy's died as well, until finally there were two owners named Webster and Wheeler, and they did not get along. They tried to work together for about 8 years, but they did not get along. And finally, Wheeler sold out to Webster, but Webster was overwhelmed and said, I don't think I can do this on my own. So he approached the Strausses and asked them if they would be willing to buy at least a part, half of the store, which they did. Mm-hmm. They bought half, and then eventually he retired from business, and they took over the entire store. And this was, they started at Macy's in 1888.
And what kind of partner was Ida for Isidore? We haven't talked about her personality yet.
Oh, she was an amazing woman. She was probably the most supportive of Victorian-type wives. She certainly was one who was talented in her own right. She was an artist. She was a poet. In fact, we have some of the artwork that she actually did has been preserved. She published at least one poem that was in the New York Times, both before and following her death. And she was, of course, primarily interested in her children and making certain that they were brought up as honorable and good and productive people. And she certainly succeeded in all of those things. But she supported Isidore as well, and he supported her in their philanthropy. Isidore, for example, was one of the founders, there were several, of an organization in New York called the Educational Alliance. And the purpose of that organization was to help immigrants, particularly Jewish immigrants, to learn to become Americans and to learn what they needed to know to get settled in this country and to live successfully in this country. They touched so many lives together, the two of them. And she had her own benevolences as well, in which he supported her. But when he went to Congress, he was a congressman from 1894 to 1896, a role that he felt he was not totally suited for, so he would not run for a second term. Mm. But while he was away, they wrote each other every single day. And in fact, there are days in which he wrote her more than once. I think of one particular occasion when he wrote her on three different occasions in one single day just to make her a part of what he was doing there in Washington.
Do you think Isidore was too honest for Washington?
That's an interesting question.
His daddy raised him to be honest.
He did, and he was. But he was a gold standard Democrat at the time, and he was very interested in he was interestingly enough, the family was very split politically. His brother Oscar was a Republican, Isidore was a Democrat, and yet when William Jennings Bryan ran with the free silver agenda as president, he did not vote Democratic that particular time. And so he and Oscar both were men of principle, mm-hmm. rather than party, strictly party.
What about Ida and Isidore's children? Tell me about them.
Well, they had six children. They had three sons and three daughters, and they lost another son in a very early age. And they all grew up, the three sons grew up to become partners in Macy's. Mm-hmm. And when their father died, of course, they went on to run this store at that point. The daughters all married very well. Two of them married doctors, and one married a stockbroker. And they went on, to lead very, very good and productive lives. There's just a very interesting family and very diverse today.
Did you get to interview any of the Strauss's descendants for this book?
Well, I did talk with some of them by email and that sort of thing. I did meet one woman particularly named Barbara Gergen, who lives in Texas now, and she was very encouraging about the book. I have since met many more of the Strausses. In a way, I kind of wanted to not be influenced, if you know what I mean. I wanted to do my own research and come to my own conclusions and then get to know the family as well. Fortunately, I was very pleased that one of the great-grandsons of Isidore, who happens to be the chair or the president of the Strauss Historical Society today, was very complimentary about the book and seemed to like it very, very much. In fact, his name is Paul Kurtzman, and we have done several joint interviews, one with the Wall Street Journal mm-hmm. and several other interviews that we've done together, or at least we've both been interviewed for those.
One more short pause. We'll be right back with more on MTSU on the Record after this.
The Middle East-centered MTSU seeks to promote greater understanding of the politics, history, and culture of this vitally important region of the world. Its mission includes the promotion of outreach programs and faculty research. The center sponsors lectures by Middle East experts and scholarly exchanges. We're especially pleased to offer a new interdisciplinary minor in Middle East Studies with courses in Arabic and Hebrew. This is Dr. Alan Hibbard, Center Director.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking with June Hall McCash about her new book, A Titanic Love Story, Ida and Isidore Strauss. Now, what compelled Ida and Isidore to board the Titanic?
Well, that, Jenna, is an interesting question because they weren't supposed to be on the Titanic. They had been on spending the winter away from what was turned out to be the coldest winter on record in New York. And they had spent it in the south of France in an area called Caumartin, which is near a little town called Roquebrune. And they had had a very pleasant winter there. They had encountered Isidore's brother and his wife briefly, just for one day, but they had had a kind of reunion there in the south of France. And Isidore had booked passage to return on a ship called the Olympic, which was another White Star ship and a sister ship of the Titanic. But there was a coal strike in England, and the Olympic had also been put in for some repairs, so her sailing was delayed. Mm-hmm. Isidore had always been rather interested in the modern ships. In fact, he had come to America. His first voyage to America had been on a ship called the Saint Louis, the Saint Louis. And he remembered that as its maiden voyage. In fact, it was the return voyage from its maiden voyage. It was going back from France to New York.
So he already knew what it felt like to be on a big ocean liner.
He did. And he had been on other ocean liners and others with maiden voyages. So he was very interested in all the newer technology. So I'm sure he was quite pleased to have been able to book passage on the Titanic when the Olympic was delayed. His children said, "There's no need to come back. Everything's okay. We can handle whatever problems may arise at the store." But Isidore wanted to get home. They had opened a new department called Old Fashioned Macy's, and it wasn't going quite as well as he had hoped it would, and he wanted to get home again to, I suppose, to see what was happening there. And so they sailed on April 10th from Southampton to return to New York.
It was a very prestigious thing to be on the maiden voyage of this particular liner because it was touted to be state-of-the-art, totally up-to-date, beyond anything anyone had ever seen or experienced before. And a lot of the elites, the upper crust, were on the Titanic, including the Astors.
Absolutely. John Jacob Astor was there, Guggenheim. There were quite a number of well-known New Yorkers who were on that vessel and who went down with the ship.
Why have they been largely peripheral figures in the fictional retellings of the Titanic saga? I'm thinking of, I've seen the 1953 movie Titanic with Clifton Webb and Barbara Stanwyck, and I've seen A Night to Remember, which was a British film from 1968 with a very young David McCallum in it, and of course the 1997 Extravaganza with Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet. And I seem to remember in each one of those movies there was a brief scene with a couple who insisted on staying together and not breaking up as the women and children were going into the lifeboats and the wife staying behind. You know, we're a couple, we got married together, we will stay together till the end kind of thing. But nobody really honed in on that as a point of focus for either any one of those movies. Instead, they created fictional characters like Jack in the modern Titanic and the Clifton Webb and Barbara Stanwyck couple in the older Titanic. I mean, this was something that really happened to real people, and they're making fiction instead of fact. They could have done the entire Titanic movie focusing on these two as the main characters in the story.
Well, then, Jenna, we need a new film, don't we? Well, the fact is, I hadn't written my book at that point, and, of course, they did not have access to the stories of the Strausses. You're right, they were briefly depicted in A Night to Remember. They were not depicted at all in the 1997 film Titanic by James Cameron. In fact, he perhaps alluded to them with an elderly couple who chose to remain in bed and go down with the ship. That, of course, was not what Ida and Isidore did.
They were standing out on the deck.
They were on deck, and they were prepared to board the lifeboats. That in itself is a quite amazing story. Ida, in fact, got into a lifeboat and realized that Isidore was not going to follow her because the captain had given orders, women and children first. And on one side of the ship, on the port side of the ship, where Second Officer Lightoller was helping to board the lifeboats, he was interpreting that very strictly, that as long as any women and children were left on the ship, no man could board. As a consequence, some of those even-numbered boats went away with as few as 23 passengers, when, in fact, they could carry 65. On the other side of the ship, there was a First Officer Murdoch was boarding the ship there, or boarding the lifeboats, and he was allowing women and children to board first, but if none were standing around, he would allow the men on board, which is how some of the men were saved. Ida and Isidore had the misfortune of being on the port side of the ship. But Ida actually stepped into a lifeboat and realized then that Isidore was not going to be able to follow her, and she stepped out again, took off her fur coat, handed it to her maid, and said, "I won't be needing this anymore," and gave her maid the seat in the lifeboat. Ellen Bird was her name. And then she turned to Isidore and said, "I'd rather die with you than live without you."
How did people come to know their story? What witnesses to it survived to tell it? Was Ms. Bird one of the people who told the story?
She was one of the witnesses, yes. She was one of the witnesses. But, of course, there were quite a few people in these various lifeboats by this time, and they all witnessed what happened between the Strausses. And, in fact, they tried to get Ida into two different lifeboats. And as the consequence was that her refusal to board a lifeboat was witnessed by probably 50 people. And in fact, at least some of the men who were standing around were saved. They weren't in the lifeboats. But I'm thinking about Archibald Butt, for example, who was a fellow Georgian and who went into the water but was ultimately picked up and saved. And he wrote a book about it and talked about his relationship with the Strausses and how they had. And I used his work because he talked about the conversations he and Isidore had as they strolled the deck. And he was standing there as the ship went down and saw what happened as well. So we had quite a few eyewitnesses and their stories. Eyewitness accounts are frequently notoriously inconsistent. These are amazingly consistent.
How old were their children when they died?
They were grown. They were probably, oldest ones were certainly in their 40s. Ida was 63. Isidore was 67. People referred to them as, quote, elderly, unquote. I think of that as rather young myself. That's the new 40 these days. But I think it's a relative kind of age in any case. But they weren't really elderly and decrepit as they seem to be thought of.
It's not as though they were leaving young toddlers behind with no mommy and daddy.
Absolutely not. All their children were married by this time, and they had all were beginning to have children of their own. They had quite a few grandchildren by this time. And so I do want to point out that I have 40 pages of pictures in the book. I think if anyone's interested in their children, there are a number of photographs of their family as they grew and as they, after they married, their spouses and so forth.
We'll take another break and we'll be back with more in just a moment. This is MTSU on the Record.
Specialized training in forensic science prepares tomorrow's professionals through the Forensic Institute for Research and Education, or FIRE. The Forensic Anthropology Search and Recovery Team assists law enforcement with skeletal remains at crime scenes. Legendary forensic scientists provide lectures free to the public, and high school students work realistic crime scenes each summer at our CSI MTSU camp. I'm Dr. Hugh Berryman, Director of FIRE.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about a Titanic love story, Ida and Isidore Strauss, with June Hall McCash, author of the book. How was the news of their deaths received?
Well, in Columbus, Georgia, of course, they were well known already as having founded Macy's, so they were well known in Columbus. Interestingly enough, even in New York, the children didn't know for 4 days whether their parents had lived or died, because the news coming in through the newspapers and so forth were totally, number one, erroneous, inconsistent. At one point, it was reported that all the Titanic passengers had been saved. Mm-hmm. The account gave the names of the ships on which they were returning. And in fact, their son Herbert, their youngest of the three sons, booked a train to Halifax, Nova Scotia, to meet his parents, only to discover that those stories were completely false. So it was kind of an emotional roller coaster for those families. But even in Georgia, Strausses were viewed as great philanthropists. And there's one account, for example, by a planter in Georgia who bemoans the loss of, particularly of Isidore Strauss, whom he saw as the primary philanthropist on the ship.
Are there any monuments or anything in their memory?
There are, of course, markers and that sort of thing in Talbotton and Columbus. Mm-hmm. For example, in Talbotton, there is a marker where their first house stood. Mm-hmm. That in itself is a very interesting site, and I do have a photograph of that first house, but it's not at all what they would come to live in New York.
Right.
It's a very modest little house set up on piers so that the air could get underneath, and like many houses, I suppose, in Georgia of that time. The house is gone now, mm-hmm. but there's still a marker at the site. In Columbus, however, when the Strausses would return, and all three of the sons, I'm speaking of Isidore, his brother Nathan, and his brother Oscar, all returned to Georgia at least once in their life and were greeted with great fanfare. And in fact, the mayor of Atlanta had a big dinner party for Ida and Isidore and introduced him to Henry Grady and others of great importance in Atlanta at the time. And the sons of Isidore eventually went back in the 1920s to open the Davison Paxson department store. And they had been very interested in continuing that connection with the state of Georgia. There in New York, however, there are quite a fair number of markers. There was a very nice plaque put up by the workers of Macy's department store, not by management, but the money was raised by the workers themselves, and it's in Macy's department store today. There was a park. 3 years later, donations came in from people all over the world, and a park called Strauss Park today stands between 106th and 107th Street on Broadway in New York. It's a tiny little sliver of land that's like an oasis of tranquility. Mm-hmm. And it stands within sight of what was their home place in New York. There is now an apartment building there called the Claiborne, which was built within a year mm-hmm. after Ida and Isidore's death. And then, of course, there is their monument in Park Lawn Cemetery, which his children raised later. His sons, there's a mausoleum for each of the three sons. But in the middle, there is an Egyptian funerary barge that marks the burial place of Isidore Strauss. Ida's body was never found. Isidore's was found floating in the North Atlantic and brought back to New York for burial. I have seen the exhibits of some of these artifacts, and I, of course, have been to one of the Titanic museums, and there are quite a few around the world. And they're extremely moving. They give you a sense of the real life of these people and the sense that these people meant something on this earth, not that they're just vague names and just spirits that are gone, but that there was a tangible quality to these people. And I must say, when I went to the Titanic Museum and I saw Isidore Strauss's wedding ring there, I was deeply touched by that.
It truly is a love story.
Oh, indeed.
June Hall McCash, thanks for being our guest today.
Thank you, Jenna. It's been a pleasure.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.